Welcome to Appointed. Today we are joined by Paul Taylor. Mr. Taylor is the Executive Director of Foodshare Toronto, and he is a lifelong anti-poverty activist. Foodshare provides 250,000 people with fresh produce and fights for the right to have access to good food. Their goal is to inspire long-term solutions for a food system where everyone has access to affordable, fresh, nutritious food. Mr. Taylor, thank you so much for joining us on Appointed.
It's an absolute pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
So to start off, I was wondering if you would mind giving us a quick definition of food insecurity.
Absolutely. And it is a pretty quick definition, because really it's about having, when I think about household food insecurity, it's about a household having inadequate or insecure access to food. Mm-hmm. But the key part to that is due to financial constraints. Mm-hmm. So really simply, it's about not having enough money to purchase all of the food a household needs.
Right. And could you tell us a little bit about Foodshare Toronto and the work you all do?
Absolutely. So Foodshare works in communities right across the city of Toronto to advance food justice. Mm-hmm. So we collaborate with these communities and community leaders to develop community-led food infrastructure. So we're talking about things like urban farms, community produce markets, school-based meal programs, even community gardens. So all kind of examples, food examples of food infrastructure that isn't focused on profit. It's community-led, it's community-run. And I think it's been really important in the context of a pandemic where more people are and more communities are concerned around making sure that they have a little bit more control over the food that they access. So while we do that work, we do that because we believe that, we know that we have a right to food in this country. Mm-hmm. So the challenge with having had made food a right is that we've also made it a commodity. So that's where we get food insecurity. If you don't have adequate income, you can't actually enjoy food. So one of the things we do is we also advocate for public policy responses to address food insecurity and poverty, as well as really working to dismantle some oppressive systems that affect who has food and who doesn't. Things like white supremacy, anti-Black racism, anti-Indigeneity. Those are all things that have an impact on food access and one's ability to be food secure. So for us, it's really important to not only acknowledge that those are key pieces to this work, but that we're actively working to dismantle those oppressive systems.
Definitely. And so you mentioned how food, access to food is a right in this country. I'm curious to know then, historically, what has Canada's response to food insecurity been?
That's a great question. And it has changed over time. It's been really interesting to observe. Prior to the 1980s, Canada focused on more income-based interventions in the same way that much of Europe had responded. But in the early 1980s, everything changed around how we respond to food insecurity. I think it was kind of the triumvirate of Thatcher, Reagan, and Mulroney that really led the retrenchment of the welfare state, privatization, really advancing pillars of the neoliberal agenda. So we went from income-based interventions to food-based interventions. Mm. And I'll note, all of this took place without any political debate in Parliament.
Wow.
And then shortly after that, so in 1981, is when we saw actually Canada's first food bank open. And for many folks, we don't know what Canada was like without food banks. They're so much a part of the food landscape now, particularly for low-income folks. But there was a time when Canada had no food banks. And since 1981, what we've seen is we've seen them grow significantly and become more institutionalized. And a part of, as I said, the low-income landscape for accessing food. And we've really, I think the parts that are particularly dangerous is they've become our default, food banks and food charity has become our default response in this country to poverty and food insecurity. Even with, when I was a child, You know, I grew up in a low-income household, and I remember going home. We were quite poor, and I remember saying to my mom that in my class we were collecting food for poor people. And she looked at me puzzled, you know, so you're going to go through our cupboards and give our food away to other poor people? So, you know, that exposes a few problems, the middle class bias, certainly in lots of education, but also that we've really enshrined food banking as the way that we collectively respond. And I think alongside that, we've reframed poverty as well. And we're much more, I think, as a country, more likely these days to use, and politicians in particular, more likely to use the language of hunger, which has allowed people to think that the solution is food. In particular, you know, the types of foods that we see from food banks, you know, corporate waste and household leftovers. So I think what's also especially noteworthy about our approach kind of since the 1980s is that food insecurity has not decreased. In fact, quite the opposite. So it's not an approach that's effectively tackling the issue. And the last thing I'll say on this is that, you know, the first food bank opened just 5 years after Canada ratified the right to food in 1976. So, and I sometimes feel that people don't understand really what it means to have a right to food, but it is a right to access food, not a right to corporate waste or other people's leftovers. It's a right to food. It's a right to be able to feed yourself, your family, and your community, one's community, with dignity now and into the future. And I think that default response that we've created since the 80s doesn't allow for that.
Right. And so you mentioned sort of this misunderstanding, maybe, of what it means for Canada to have declared kind of an access or a right to food. So why do you think Canada has chosen to respond to food insecurity in the way you've just described?
It's cheaper. It takes the burden of responsibility off of the federal government, you know, and one of the things that we see is, you know, as part of the progressive realization of the right to food, countries that have ratified the right to food are required, I believe it's every 5 years, are required to provide to the Food and Agricultural Organization of the United Nations a periodic review of where we're at. And routinely, bureaucrats will report out on charity, numbers of people accessing food banks and the like. So it's pretty common to see politicians at food banks sorting tins that get distributed to folks who are poor or food insecure. But what I'm more interested in seeing, and my colleagues and I are more interested in seeing, are politicians perhaps put down those tins and actually sort a policy that's going to have a significant impact on public policy on people's ability to access food and not to have to live in poverty.
Definitely. So when I was preparing for this interview, I went over to FoodShare's website and I saw that you all talk about how Black households are 3.56 times more likely to be food insecure than white households. Could you please unpack this statistic for us?
Absolutely. I think, you know, when we did this research, we partnered with Proof, a research institution out of the University of Toronto, and we were just gobsmacked, you know, to imagine that Black folks in this country are 3.5 times more likely to be food insecure than white folks is pretty profound, was pretty profound for many of us. And also when you look at children, you know, our research also pointed to, you know, 12% of white children live in food insecure households versus 36% of Black children. And I find myself, you know, we were scratching our heads trying to understand what was happening here. But it's not difficult, you know, when you start to look at other data out there. Things like, you know, I came across that 42% of children in the care of the Children's Aid Society of Toronto are Black, despite making up only 12% of the city's population. And then when we look at, you know, how many kids get expelled from school that are Black, you know, 48% of those expelled from school in Toronto are Black, again, despite making up only 12% of the Toronto school population. So I think what this research reinforced for us is that anti-Black racism is built into our institutions. It's everywhere. It affects who eats, who has food, and who doesn't. So as we, you know, we got this data, and the first bit of information we started to learn was, you know, around the variance, the 3.5% variance. So then we started scratching our heads, trying to understand what was happening, what else could be happening, what policy tools are available to address this. Mm-hmm. So we looked at things like household composition. Is there more likely to be a single parent or dual parent household? What's happening? And we found that the prevalence remained high, regardless of whether or not it was a single parent or dual parent household. And I think that's really important, because when we talk about food security aggregately in this country, or food insecurity aggregately in this country, we recognize that household composition, so someone in a single parent household, is more likely to be food insecure. When we did this research that focused specifically on the Black community, what we found is it didn't matter whether or not there was one or two parents, the prevalence remained high. We even looked at immigration status, you know, to try and figure out what was happening there. And we found that it didn't matter if a Black person was born in Canada or born abroad or how long they had lived in Canada, the prevalence remained high. Then there were a few other pieces that we looked at that really reinforced how pervasive anti-Black racism is in our institutions. So we looked at things like social assistance, for example. Mm-hmm. So some people who are food insecure are on social assistance. The majority of people that are food insecure are working. I think it's important to point that out. But some are on social assistance. And what we found as we're looking at the data was that white folks in this country actually receive more in social assistance payments than Black folks do. And we couldn't understand why, because welfare, you know, seems like it's a few calculations, punch a few things here, and then out spouts a number. But we were reminded that the social assistance calculations include disability income supports. So what we've inferred is that that variance is a result of white folks being more likely to be approved for disability and more likely to be approved for more money. Mm. We also, you know, when we think about home ownership in this country aggregately and its relationship to food insecurity, typically if you own a home, you're less likely to be food insecure. Mm-hmm. We thought that made a lot of sense. But again, when we did this research specifically looking at the experiences of food insecurity in the Black community, we actually found that Black homeowners, so it's about 14.3% of Black homeowners that are food insecure, which is almost equivalent to the 14.5% of white renters that are food insecure.
Wow.
So ultimately, this research told us that the most important factor here that accounts for this variance is simply being racialized as Black. Nothing else, and the prevalence of anti-Black racism.
That is devastating, truly. So on this note, I'm wondering if you could help us make the connection between food insecurity, inadequate housing, precarious employment, poverty, and racism.
I like this question a lot, and I think it's a great follow-up question to the previous one, because yes, this information is so alarming and problematic in a lot of ways, but it really makes a key link that I think had been absent from a lot of the analysis in kind of food community food organizations or the community food security sector, because these issues are interconnected. Mm-hmm. We can't solve food insecurity with a ministry for food. You know, we need more joined up policy that tackles food insecurity, that tackles poverty, that provides housing, that provides affordable childcare, and so on. Because all of those things that you listed before, you know, those like food insecurity, inadequate housing, poverty, and precarious employment are all things that Black and brown folks have had disproportionately bestowed upon us as a result of white supremacy and systemic racism, mm-hmm. with particular emphasis on anti-Black racism and anti-indigeneity. Mm-hmm. And I think in the context of, you know, I'd be remiss not to talk about the pandemic. And I think in the context of the pandemic, the connection has been made so clear. Neighborhoods that are the most hard hit are those that are predominantly Black and brown communities, communities with low income, significant history of underinvestment in those communities, and poor access to services. So the response mechanisms to these issues, which another thing that's problematic is the way in which we typically respond to these issues are through mechanisms that are predominantly led by white folks, whether it's community organizations or government bureaucrats or even our policymakers, predominantly white folks. So we have this kind of white universalism. That's a really big issue that often goes unacknowledged, unchecked. You know, we have white folks who are setting policies and developing programs that they might feel may work for them, but they are assuming that these policies and programs also work for Black and Brown folks who are more represented in these statistics. So deeply connected issues, all of them. And big problems in the way that we address them. But there is an opportunity to have a much more thoughtful conversation and approach to addressing food insecurity in this country.
So according to research, rates of food insecurity actually drop once an individual turns 65. And this is mostly due to the benefits that seniors have access to, such as old age security and the guaranteed income supplement. These two programs are, in many ways, akin to a guaranteed livable income program. Now, you've read Senator Pate's perspective document on guaranteed livable income, and I'm curious to know what your thoughts are on a guaranteed livable income.
So many of us in the food movement for a long time have said we need a guaranteed livable income. We need an income floor that is going to, we've actually pointed to, as you've done, we've pointed to the experience of seniors and said, actually, we've got a basic income in this country. And we see the impact that it has on seniors. It can have significant impact on the population at large. I'm going to go back to this research that we did with Proof, because one of the things we found through this research is, yes, it is true aggregately when someone becomes a senior, when folks become seniors and they can access their retirement income, the prevalence of food insecurity decreases. When we look specifically at the Black population in this country and what happens when Black folks become a senior, it doesn't have the same effect. The prevalence is still high.
Okay.
So I think we need a few other tools in the tool belt to respond to food insecurity. So the first thing we need to do is we need to focus on collecting race-based data. That's essential, and we need to report out on the race-based data. Because if we recognize that there are communities that are specifically vulnerable to issues like food insecurity, have been specifically made vulnerable to issues like food insecurity, well, then we need to make sure that our interventions are having an impact on those that have been made most vulnerable. Because and tackling anti-Black racism is also another key piece of this work. It is a food insecurity intervention as much as housing and poverty, as much as it is, you know, an intervention around housing and poverty. Anti-Black racism is so much at the heart of these issues that we can't ignore it. I also, you know, I talked a little bit about white universalism and white supremacy and how it's shaped some of the solution finding. And one thing I think about when I think about basic income, and first I'm going to acknowledge it is a critical and important tool in the tool belt for attacking food insecurity, 100% without a doubt. But it's also a go-forward intervention. And it has me reflecting on who has the ability to have a go-forward approach.
Right.
And it's often not Black folks who have had to suffer generations of lost opportunity, lost wealth, the health implications, and the like. So I think in addition to a go-forward approach, we also need to be having a conversation about what restitution looks like for the health inequities, the inequities that systems and institutions have created. And we may have to be talking about reparations. But I'm also of the view that we have to take a step back. And again, I'm going to acknowledge basic income is key a key tool. But I think I'm really interested in advancing, having more conversations about human rights, especially in one of the richest countries in the world. Mm-hmm. We should be able to expect a decent quality of life and the protection of our human rights, like food and housing in this country. So for me, a decent quality of life framework would include an income floor or a guaranteed livable income, plus a guarantee of publicly provided services like childcare, affordable housing. And when I say affordable housing, I mean a commitment to meet the current need for affordable housing, the demand. You know, if these things have to come together, and work together, we really do need some joined up policy to address these things, because we know if we have an income floor that's established, but we see housing prices continue to soar, a childcare continue to be unaffordable for many, well, then it's not going to have the kind of desired impact. So, and I think, like I said, it needs to be rooted in, we should expect a decent quality of life for everyone who lives on this land. And anything but that is a reflection of a broken system. So let's fix the system, not with one intervention, but let's look at all of the tools that need to be deployed to advance a decent quality of life for everyone.
Definitely. I completely agree. And I wanted to follow up with a few things you said, Paul. You talked about, tackling anti-Black racism, and I'm wondering what that looks like to you at those government levels where policies are being developed.
Mm-hmm. It looks like a lot of things. So even before, I would say government in a lot of ways is not unlike or other businesses and organizations across the city. Across the country, excuse me. So I run an organization based in Toronto, and we've actually had to think about that ourselves. What does it mean to tackle white supremacy and anti-Black racism within your organization? Mm-hmm. So we've introduced a number of new processes and ways of thinking about things. One, we have a Black caucus that provides ongoing advice to us around our development of a strategy aimed at tackling anti-Black racism within the organization. It's about how we recruit. It starts with how we recruit folks to join us. You know, we can post on Workopolis or any of those traditional sites, and we'll get the same middle-class white folks applying for these positions. But if we actually intentionally building relationships with community groups and organizations that work with Black and Indigenous and other racialized folks and other members of equity-seeking groups, then we call up those community groups and the like and say, we've got this posting, let us know if you have any questions, please mm-hmm. feel free to share it with folks in your network. We also have an anonymized review process. We've deprioritized paid accreditation mm-hmm. When possible. So, you know, really wonderful that so many people have these degrees, but many people don't, because many folks couldn't afford to leave home for 4 years and live somewhere else. Mm-hmm. Student loans are not always adequate to cover the costs, people's costs. Mm-hmm. So we have actually deprioritized paid accreditation and have prioritized instead lived experience and have ongoing conversations about how do you interview? How do you assess candidates based on those prioritizations? We happen to be a Black-led organization, but the chair of our board is an Indigenous woman, an activist, founder of Idle No More Toronto. And then we also have an advisory committee made up of 60 folks that we bring together. We provide dinner, we provide childcare, we provide an honorarium. And that committee is made up predominantly of BIPOC folks, Black and Indigenous and other people of color, who provide advice and guidance to us on some big picture items. So developing our strategic plan, looking at our mission, vision, and values, all of those sorts of pieces are ways that we have said we want to disrupt the status quo approach that historically is not helpful at advancing racial justice within organizations and businesses. So a number of things like that.
That's great. That's awesome. Now, another question I just want to, a follow-up about something you said. You talked about reparations, and I'm wondering, again, what this would look like for you.
Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, certainly Black folks are not a monolith, so I wouldn't want to...
Of course, yeah, yeah.
Prescribe, like, a certain... This is what it looks like. But what I think might be helpful is, you know, if the government perhaps started a listening process and then through that process identified four or five things that folks could choose from, and one of which would be cash to help compensate or, like I said, provide restitution for the ways in which society has limited opportunity and has poorly impacted health for Black folks. But it could look like a whole host of other things as well. It could be perhaps access to land, perhaps a home, you know, who knows? But I think it's something that we need to be talking about more broadly. And I think part of the reason we aren't talking about it more broadly is because of the prevalence of white supremacy. So I would love us to have more spaces to be able to identify what reparations could look like so that we can truly begin to move on and embrace go-forward approaches.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's great. Thank you so much, Paul, for speaking with me today. I really appreciate it. Is there anything else that you'd like to add before I let you go?
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It's been a huge pleasure. And I guess I'll just add for anyone that's listening that, you know, this pandemic has certainly created a moment for us to pause and think about what this country could be. And I just encourage everyone to dream in color and to dream big and to dream bold. You know, like I said, we live in one of the richest countries in the world. Mm-hmm. We have an opportunity to not only lead, but really be an example of what's possible. Mm-hmm. So I hope that we seize this moment, and I think it's all of our responsibilities to push our politicians, push our elected officials to ensure that we truly do seize this moment to do something big.
Definitely. I 100% agree.